some people become quite happy learning about the Buddha's teachings on suffering. Some people become quite happy because they feel or understand that for the first time in their life, someone's actually talking about suffering. They somehow had picked up that there's a lot of suffering in this world, in this life, and that a lot of people were avoiding it, denying it, covering it over. And here was someone who really addressed it directly, and that's a relief. Some people, they become happy because the teachings on suffering point to the end of suffering, to freedom from suffering. And the possibility of that is quite inspiring for some people. We're not stuck as semi-professional sufferers. Some people are quite happy hearing it because not only is there a possibility to end suffering, there's a path, there's a process by which one can do that. And even though some people don't feel like they'll ever get to the end of that path, they're very happy being on the path. That it's a very worthwhile thing to do in this life. And a simple way of talking about that process is a steady and gradual lessening of suffering, a slow and steady lessening of harming. One of the goals of Buddhism is to become a person who does not harm oneself or harm others. And that could be a definition of the goal of practice. I like that definition because it's interpersonal. You know, to have the goal being some big bang experience of enlightenment. That's good. But I've known people who've had, there's a lot of big bang experiences. Different kinds, different varieties, different flavors. And I've known people who've had some of those who only became more conceited because of it, more attached. And I've known people who have suffered because of it, either trying to attain it or and having it, holding on to it. But if the end goal is to is the ending of harming self or others, that's pretty safe. That, with that in mind, it's kind of a protection against using Buddhism to suffer more. So the goal is rarely defined as being the end result is to be happy, though sometimes it is. There are places where people who are fully matured in the practice are talked about as having being happy and being peaceful. I think it's probably the primary characterization of such people in the suttas, at least kind of emotionally. And the Buddha sometimes is called the happy one. But there seems to be a little reluctance to call the goal as happiness. It's more often defined as the absence of something, the absence of the causes of suffering, greed, hate, and delusion. And what's nice about that is that then, you know, it's a little bit harder to get attached to an absence. It's a little bit harder to specify exactly what that experience is. Maybe there's a lot of experiences that come along with absence. It doesn't have to be a singular one. And so, but if you say the goal is to be happy, well then, maybe too many of us would try to smile too much, thinking we're supposed to be a certain way, and get fatigued cheeks. But the path of liberation, the path that we walk along this, is a path that is, of the path itself is described as being steps in it that involve called well-being, happiness, joy, bliss, gladness, whatever words you want to, whatever you want to translate some of these words into English. And it's very explicit about the happiness along the way to full maturity. And some people find it a little bit confusing because you know they're unhappy. That's why they've come to practice, and then they're told that they think that somehow that enlightenment or something is going to make them happy, but now they're told to become happy first. So how am I supposed to be happy when I'm unhappy? Well, that's part of what the practice is to learn something about well-being, to learn something about the nature of well-being, of happiness, of joy, to learn to appreciate it, value it, recognize it, and also to, in the appropriate ways, to evoke it or put the conditions in place that bring it about. And so that's the subject of today, and we're calling it well-being, the three qualities to cultivate being stability, confidence, and well-being. I'm fond of this word well-being, and we'll kind of like using it as the general word for the topic today, because a few reasons. One is I think it's a little bit more humble and ordinary and then happiness. Happiness is it's maybe a little bit too much sometimes, you know. And it maybe sets the bar too high, or it's too narrow. But well-being in English, in my English at least, is kind of a simple word. I feel it's a broad word and encompasses so much without being too specific. So a lot of things fit into it, and it's just kind of, for me, a breath, which is nice. Whereas in my, funny use of English, I think of, happiness as being much narrower in scope. It's a little more energetic, it's a little more kind of, it's more, for me, happiness is more tall, and well-being is broad. I'm sure you have other associations with these words, but you'll hopefully go along with me, just at least to listen. But as I give this talk on these topics of happiness, well-being, joy, I'm not going to give it as a guided meditation, but you might consider it a guided meditation. And rather than arguing with what I have to say, you might kind of listen to the words and the ideas and see, is there anything in your experience that relates to that you've experienced? Anything you can find in your body or an association within you for these qualities and what I'll talk about as we go along here. So if I use the word joy, what does that feel like inside? How does that resonate? What do you know about joy inside? As a feeling, as a sense. If I talk about happiness, how does that feel? And what does that touch inside? And what do you know about that? Maybe even if it's just a teeny little bit of a hint. or if it's, you can even be wonderful if you can't really feel some quality of joy or happiness or gladness, or maybe you can at least imagine you're doing it. That counts. So they kind of follow along. And part of the reason to cultivate well-being, as we've said, is to put ourselves in a better place to be able to experience, see, look directly at, feel the fullness of suffering, of our distress, our discouragement, our grief, our bitterness, our, you know, all these different things that could be called suffering, our stress. And this ability to really look it in the eye and really see it for what it is and not sidestep it, not avoid it, not escape from it, but in a very dignified and strong way to show up for our suffering, not to suffer better, but to find freedom in it. And it's a lot easier to do that if you show up for suffering with well-being, with joy and happiness, and you really, that's kind of penetrates and really present for us and integrated in some way in us. Then it's a lot easier to have these deep insights. So when the Buddha talked about, discussed to describe the path of liberation, the practices and the experiences that are part of that, the direct path of liberation, he presented two sets of practices. One category of practices are practices that have to do with letting go or not doing something, abstaining from something. So a family of practices like that. And the other family of practices were the practices that have to do with being aware, so like mindfulness. And one of those two categories of practice he describes as bringing about well-being, happiness. And the category of practices that bring about well-being are the letting go practices, the practice of abstaining from things. And so that's a curious thing. And people, you know, mindfulness folks like some of us, maybe would have preferred if he said mindfulness is the one. Because then it's a good, you know, advertisement. You know. But unfortunately, he did not connect the two directly in the way that he did the letting go practices. But perhaps because the awareness practice is what somehow leads to the letting go practices, or supports it, or is part of the, they work together. And so the first, in the family of letting go practice, the first step of the kind of description of a path of practices leading to liberation begins with sila, with ethics, ethical behavior. And the way that's described is all described by what you don't do. That's why perhaps sila shouldn't be translated as virtue, because that sounds like something positive that you have and you cultivate. But in fact, for the Buddha, it was all about what you don't do. And what you don't do are some of the coarser forms of harming people. So you don't kill, you don't steal, engage in sexual misconduct or harming through our sexuality. Don't lie, don't intoxicate. And there's other, you know, lists of things what you don't do, but those are the, you know, some of the highlights. And if you do those things, or if you don't do those things, actually, if you do the not doing, then you can have the bliss of blamelessness. That's pretty cool. And the joy or the happiness, the well-being that comes knowing that no one can blame you for how you've lived your life, your behavior. Though, of course, the Buddha was not in, it had no contact with modern American culture, where people are guilty just because they are wrong before they've done anything. It's amazing, you know, the sense of self-deprecation and criticism and feeling wrong that goes on in this culture here. There's a story of the Dalai Lama being told this. He has to ask a question about it, and there's a long exchange between translator and Dalai Lama because he was trying to understand, and he finally understood what was being said. Dalai Lama started crying to know there was such a society where somehow there's something about the way people think, the way people understand themselves, that seems to kind of produce a lot of people who have a lot of self-criticism and feel bad about themselves. And if you have it, you might want to consider it as not a personal issue, but you've kind of been hijacked by our society, parts of you. It's a societal issue. And it's very hard sometimes to, you know, when the societal conditioning is so strong, to understand even one's own self. And when I first heard about the bliss of blamelessness for one's ethical conduct, I thought that was weird. But over time, I came to appreciate it and value it a lot. And for many of us, I think it needs to be, or it doesn't come as, you know, it's not natural to feel happy for the fact that we, since Sunday, I don't think anyone here since Sunday has killed anyone. Or I don't think anyone here has stolen or probably hasn't hurt anyone with sexual activity or maybe even energy. And you haven't talked much, so the chances of lying is probably pretty small, except to yourself. And I trust that no one's been taking intoxicants here. That's a pretty phenomenal thing. And probably didn't occur to many of you to actually consider that and think, wow, look at that. For 3 days I've managed to not do those things. That's pretty cool. But if you put it, what you're doing here, in the context of what goes on in the world at large, it's pretty fantastic. I appreciate so much the people who are in recovery and the joy, the celebration, the pride, the self-worth that comes from, you know, these milestones, the year, even like sometimes a month, and then like a year and 10 years. And they know how important it is. It's how wonderful it is. And I've known people who felt that with their speech. I remember once this woman came to me and said, I sat at a retreat with you a year ago, and after that retreat, I stopped being cynical, and I stopped talking cynically. And I'm happy about that. That was really amazing. And so I feel so much delight that my speech now has changed. So it might not be second nature to think this way, but you might kind of appreciate yourself or be reason to appreciate yourself, your ethical life. And I think generally people who are in this scene have a very ethical lives. And so the bliss of what we don't do. And then there's the next kind of happiness. Translators sometimes call it bliss as well. The word is sukha. It has to do with Generally, it's called restraint of the senses. I like to call it safeguarding ourselves with the senses, sense doors. And it's often easily to misunderstand this practice because it sounds like you're not supposed to look at anything, smell anything, hear anything, touch anything, taste anything, because those are senses. You're supposed to restrain the senses. Somehow it's like putting on blinders and walking through the world and avoiding. I don't think that's the intention. Rather, how it's described is that you would be attentive as you see and hear and feel and listen and smell. And as those senses operate, you'd be present enough and attentive enough to avoid grasping onto it, clinging to it, getting entangled with it. And it's a way of protecting oneself, because to get entangled and get contracted or gripping onto the sense world, if you're really attentive, you feel the suffering of it. You feel how it's contracting and limiting, and it doesn't really feel good inside. But it takes a lot of attention to feel that, because sometimes the allure of pleasure that's part of it camouflages the stress that comes with being that way. Sometimes, coming on retreat and meditating for 3-4 days is enough to give people a clear perspective of, it's simply not worth reaching out, being preoccupied by something or with pleasure and wanting, because you can feel the limitation, you feel what's lost in that preoccupation. There's a presence, there's awareness, our thinking has quieted down. It's so good to finally be present. Why would I lose that by now chasing after being preoccupied with some kind of pleasure? So this also, to have this restraint or this care, or this care not to get entangled with what goes on in the senses, to stay right there, the moment by moment in the place where we encounter the world, and being careful, sensitive, and caring about ourselves, to not reach forward or not pull away, just stay there, be there, that also brings about a certain kind of bliss or happiness. So one of the implications of this that I think of is that the reason it is all about what you don't do and what you abandon and stop doing is that it's possible that suffering takes work. And if we stopping doing the work that allows something like a more natural kind of happiness to appear, it's as if inherent in our system is a certain kind of happiness, well-being, joy, delight, something that's here, but it very easily gets covered over in ways that we can't see so easily, but they have to do with, it's an activity of the mind, the wanting of the mind, the hostility of the mind, the aversion of the mind, the beliefs we're operating under. Beliefs can seem like they're weightless and effortless to have, but it takes work to crank up beliefs, believe it or not. One of the things that can be seen, and one of the advantages of in those times when meditation can get very still and quiet, the mind gets very quiet, and you can see the arising of a belief or a thought, and you can feel the work of it. You can feel the energy that goes into it. Or another way of seeing it that I think maybe is more common for meditators is to have some kind of mental preoccupation. So it could be a very pleasant fantasy. And so it's pretty cool and nice and satisfying and to have this wonderful fantasy, and maybe it's like, you know, one of the best sexual fantasies ever a human being has ever had, and, you know, so that justifies it. You know, it's so nice. And that's good for 2-3 sittings, 6-7 sittings. Wake up the next morning, and there it is again. And then they're like, you know, no, I don't even want to go sit anymore. I have to go back and do that again. And it's, you know, it gets, after a while, it becomes exhausting. And it's like, wow, this is tiring. And why does my mind keep doing this? And so only through repetition and repetition do we see the limitation of it. And give me a break. That's a story I've told many times, is that I spent 3 days fixated on a particular fantasy about having to do with helicopters, of all things. I don't know anything about aerodynamics, aeronautics, but, you know, somehow my concentration got locked onto this thought, and I was just so, what? Give me a break. And I got so tired. Another place where I saw it, the tiredness of this way the mind works, I was working, was when I was, I don't know, probably 21 or so, I loved going to bookstores, and I noticed that I had no money, so I couldn't really buy books. But I go into bookstores, and I would just love looking at all the titles and look at them, and then I'd leave the bookstore after a couple hours, and I'd be exhausted. So I got curious, why am I getting exhausted in the bookstore? And after, it took a while to see, and I said, it's because there was a constant stream of wanting. I want that book, I want that book, I want that book. I had no, you know, I have a great capacity to want. want. And so, and that wanting was exhausting. So there's a lot of, so the clinging and wanting and not wanting and judging and criticizing and believing anything at all, actively believing and operating and just churning that and ruminating on all this stuff is tiring, it's exhausting, it's limiting, it can generate discomfort, unhappiness. But what I wanted to emphasize is that it involves work. We have to be actively doing something. And so if we stop the doing, it gives a chance for something deeper to show itself. And that can be a variety of things. I'm not going to say that happiness is the only thing that we see, but it makes room for happiness. Or it's as if we can then touch into the well-being that's here. And I would like to propose to you the idea, the theory, that you're actually a happier person than you realize. Or that, if that doesn't, the idea doesn't work, that there's more well-being, joy, and happiness available for you than you are availing yourself of. There's all these great things going on. I mean, isn't it kind of a little bit of kind of a nice thing, pleasant thing, to be in a building with 40-some people who are pretty basically kind, basically ethical, and mostly leaving you alone to be yourself? I think it's pretty nice practicing. There are some people who are cooking for everyone else, but isn't it nice for those who are being cooked for? And the people who are cooking have people who clean up for them sometimes through their pots. That's pretty cool. The weather is nice. Go out in the garden and there's a little teeny itsy bitsy bit of joy or delight to just look at the flowers or the plants. And but you know, if we have really good mental preoccupations, then we have better things to do, right? Than to feel the, you know, to experience the joy of the moment. The pleasure of eating. So the idea being that we're often preoccupied, there's a lot of preoccupation that goes on in the mind that limits how, and is selective for how much we can experience of the well-being, the joy, the delight of the moment. And I'm certainly not suggesting kind of some kind of romantic or Pollyannish kind of idea that you're supposed to just feel the, all the goodness and the joy and the beauty and just kind of go around like that, smelling the flowers, and that'll be great. Practice is a serious looking at how we get entangled, how we get caught, and how we suffer. But we have a selectivity bias in certain ways that limit the range of experiencing ourselves and experience the moment. And so with these practices of letting go, our letting go of how we limit that range, limit the way in which we get caught. If we're being unethical and killing and stealing and such so forth, not only are we probably preoccupied in some way, chances are we're being selfish. And selfish, if you pay attention to it, is a big ouch. It hurts. But if you are ethical in the right way, not clinging to the ethics or something, that selfishness is not there, and that preoccupation is not there, and it's as if something beautiful can well up. If we're not entangled in the sense world, there's more room and space for something else to show itself. We don't have a selectivity bias towards sense pleasure. The next kind of happiness that Buddha talked about in this path to liberation is contentment. And I think of contentment as a variation of happiness. To be content, with wise content, with some of that your basic needs are satisfied. That you have a roof over your head, you have enough food, you have adequate clothes, your accommodations are adequate. To be content with what you have. And which is for some people quite difficult, not only because in and of itself, but our society encourages a kind of discontent. Because you're supposed to be consumers. I've been told by several people that maybe it's true, that the Thai government prohibited the monks to teach about contentment because they didn't want because they wanted to keep the economy humming and going. And if you're content, then you won't buy and make and all that. So contentment. The joy of contentment. When I think of that, I think of the joy of not having to always be wanting. The wanting is overrated. Constant wanting. And then the next happiness the Buddha talked about was the happiness that comes when we're no longer preoccupied with the hindrances. And the hindrances being preoccupation with sensual desire, preoccupation with ill will, preoccupation with sloth and torpor, preoccupation with restlessness and regrets, and preoccupation with doubt. And these are very important forces in the mind that Vipassana students learn about and learn to recognize and learn to be wise about. And as they, as we develop concentration, as we learn not to recognize them and not be caught by them, the Buddha described the happiness or joy that can come from that in dramatic terms. He said, it's like someone who's in debt getting out of debt. Someone who has a sickness no longer sick. Someone who's imprisoned getting out of prison. Someone who is, the fifth one is someone who is in a caravan going across vast desert, and they get out of the desert. And the fourth one was, that's four is enough. The fourth one is someone who's enslaved and is freed from slavery. So those are all kind of dramatic images, you know. What a difference that is. And sometimes people on retreat who are struggling with hindrances, they can be quite strong. We have to respect their strength. It can be such a relief they're no longer there. And there can be a kind of gladness and joy. And you're encouraged to feel glad, to feel that's good. You're allowed to feel glad. You're glad to feel, wow, this is nice, this is good. And then the Buddha goes on to describe something which I think is quite amazing. And it speaks to that there are natural processes in our system that move towards health, psychological health, natural processes that move towards liberation, natural processes that open up towards happiness. It's kind of like if we stop being preoccupied and are mindful and present, it's kind of like there's space in our system to feel well-being and joy and happiness. And so he says that when the hindrances are abated, it sets in motion a five-step process. That's not something we do the way it's described, but it's a five-step process that unfolds or grows or evolves in the wake of being present, being here, and not constantly being lost in preoccupation. And that process is to be glad about that. And when we're glad, the Buddha said, then there arises, not that, it doesn't say, and then we make happen, then there arises joy. When there's joy, there arises tranquility of the body. The body becomes tranquil. So that's a nice feeling. Very nice. And then if the body becomes tranquil, then there can be happiness. Happiness arises. And if happiness arises, then a person becomes concentrated. That the condition for concentration is not huffing and puffing, not kind of bearing down, but rather it arises out of a modicum of tranquility, relaxation, happiness, and then this concentration can happen. So there's a lot of letting go, contentment, letting go of the hindrances, and then this process gets in, sometimes it can feel like you're on a conveyor belt, you're being carried along, things are unfolding, and sometimes it feels like I've caught the wave, like I'm surfing right now, okay, I'm on the wave now. And then you kind of get carried. And then the Buddha describes further steps of greater and greater happiness and joy. And I won't go through all of them, but one of the first ones he describes, second step along it, he describes a metaphor, which I love, this metaphor, and that is of a lake into which there flow no water from the ground, no rivers come into it, and there's no rain that replenishes it. What replenishes it and refreshes it is there's an underwater spring in that lake. So there's, you know, maybe, you know, so the spring bubbles up from the floor of the lake, and you can imagine, you know, this cool, fresh, pure water that flows upwards like a big underwater fountain, spreads through the lake, fills the lake with new water. And this idea that from the inside, something arises inside of us and spreads out is used as a description of joy arising in a meditator. So it comes from deep down. It doesn't come from the head. It doesn't come from thinking joyful thoughts. It doesn't come out of, you know, planning and making happen from the mind. But it wells up someplace deep inside. And what it means is it's a joy that arises for no external reason. It's joy that doesn't depend on winning the California lottery or getting I don't want to give you things to think about, but getting some beautiful, wonderful, perfect car. Or, you know, I can go through the list of all these external things, right? And it's phenomenal to start feeling this welling up inside of well-being, of joy, of happiness, gladness, that in a certain kind of way has no external cause. It's kind of something that lives inside of us and wells up. The inner causes for it are not being preoccupied, being able to be really present and concentrated for in the moment, and being receptive and open in the whole physical system to be filled by something. And this movement of kind of opening up and allowing ourselves to be filled to allow, to make space for, make room, as if you're opening yourself up and allowing something to well up into you. Because if we're preoccupied and think, well, something, this has to happen, that has to happen, I'm a mess, I'm all this, you know, there's no room. But if we get quieter in the mind, even if it's just for a few seconds, we're quiet in the mind, not so much thoughts, and we're able to soften and relax in the body and feel the body from the inside out and allow something to flow, allow something to appear. And as we're practicing along this path, at some point there's this feelings of well-being that begin surfacing. And they can be very small feelings. It doesn't have to be dramatic with fireworks and all that. It can be very sweet and subtle. It can be hints. It doesn't have to be spreading through the whole body. It might be a subtle vibration in the solar plexus, or in the belly, or in the cheeks, the face, in the hands. It might be a sensation of, even the eyes closed, that the visual field feels like it becomes lighter, brighter. Or it might feel like the head opens up and there's like no roof on the skull. Just seems open and refreshed. Subtle tingling or a sense of warmth or contentment. Delight. Or maybe there's a subtle coziness. and to feel even the small little pieces of this inside of us, to breathe with it, to breathe, and kind of like the breathing is like the bellows that are gently fanning a flame, and keep opening and feel it. Make your body a receptacle for well-being. A receptacle that the thinking mind becomes just quiet enough that there's more room to feel all this. And one of the reasons to not be so concerned with what we're thinking or be caught up in thought, let thinking mind become quiet, is because it actually gives a lot more room in the field of awareness to feel and sense the goodness that's here, the flow that's here. And paradoxically, this sense of some sense of well-being can coexist with not feeling good, feeling sad or grief or angry and all that. And I think sometimes I've seen in myself that my attention has been very selective. And sometimes I've been very good at selecting what is unpleasant, what is not good, you know, and how I'm feeling, if I'm feeling, you know, sad or upset or something. It's just sometimes it's like I don't know, it's like a radar that prioritizes that, you know, a magnet. That's what's important. And maybe it is somewhat important to look at it and see it directly and practice with it. But if it's done selectively or with blinders on, then we miss the fact that at the same time, there are some feelings of well-being and stability. I've noticed sometimes that when I focus on how I don't feel good, that I actually don't feel very stable. And so there's a lack of stability in that because I'm kind of caught up in the agitated or the work or the active part of life that's all about concerned about things. So what I've learned is to kind of expand my attention to notice simultaneous to not feeling very well, to find out where it is I feel stable, where I feel some confidence, and where there's something, some modicum of well-being or pleasure or pleasantness. And generally, if I do that, that feels stabilizing. It kind of, I feel like I have like a floor or a foundation then. And from there, I can then be aware of what's difficult. But it's a very different context for experiencing it than if I just, you know, get absorbed in the difficulty. I find it remarkable. Sometimes, you know, I've had a hard time getting concentrated, and especially my early years of practice, and, you know, I was supposed to get concentrated, and I huff and puff. And I would conclude, I can't concentrate. But in retrospect, I realized that I had a very good capacity for concentration if I just had the right thing to concentrate on. And, you know, I could concentrate really well on what a lousy person I was. That really got my attention. Or my resentments. Boy, you know, talk about one-pointed concentration. Got it, you know. And so to kind of break the trance of some of these unfortunate places to concentrate and open up the awareness, start feeling, is there any well-being or contentment or joy or delight or contentment or something here that can be create a different context or a different feeling for, different atmosphere for being honest and taking in the fact that, yeah, there are these difficult states here, and they're not the full story. Then I don't have to be 100% preoccupied with it, but it's something to pay attention to through the framework of some of the feeling, settled, stable, present, here. So what I'm talking about today is not meant to give you more things to do, but more of what I hope is that kind of, not exactly doing, but more to be open to or to be aware of maybe what you haven't been noticing yet. To be noticed and be aware with a quieter mind. If you allow your mind to get a little bit quiet, kind of like quiet like you would if you were listening to a sound far in the distance, subtle sounds, very faint sound, and you might let your mind get really quiet so you can hear better. To let your mind become softer and quieter, and maybe you can tune in to layers of well-being, to qualities of well-being, contentment, joy, gladness, delight, satisfaction, pleasure, pleasantness, that might be here that you've been overlooking. Or if you start getting focused and concentrated, there's something about that concentration that quiets all that doing and the work of the mind, the other works of the mind, the desiring and wanting and aversion. And as that, all that active stuff gets quieter and you get a little more settled, is there in fact in the edges of your experience something pleasant and enjoyable and well-being? And if so, can you continue doing the mindfulness, the concentration practice, and take that in, like you're, or open up to it, or make room for it, as you, like if you're focusing on the breathing. Almost as if the breathing opens it, the breathing expands out into it. It's a remarkable body we have, remarkable body, mind, and heart. There's much more here in your body and mind and heart than we have usually tapped into. What if you sit today and tomorrow taking an interest, being curious, what is here? What forms of well-being might already be here? What forms of well-being are beginning to well up like an underwater spring? What is it that I'm overlooking? What is it I can tap into? What is it that can maybe support me, so that my awareness feels like I'm creating a mind, a heart, where it's nice for awareness to come into. Awareness wants to be present because the atmosphere is kind of nice here. And I know that what I'm talking about today can be difficult at times for anyone. It's not easy. There are times where it's not easy to feel any kind of well-being or joy. So I want to make sure that you understand that I know that, and that's not a fault that you can't feel joy. And sometimes it's very important to feel the opposite and really. And so if you're really, this what's has to happen for you in your process is you have to really, for the first time maybe ever, really give up and suffer really well and not try to fight it or run away from it. And you're going to just suffer. Maybe even then, there can be a little teeny bit of joy that you are on the path to practice. That this is a healthy thing to do. You're in the place where that's what we do, is to move through it, beyond it. And you're very fortunate to have a practice to meet that suffering. And so maybe there can be a little bit of joy. At least I have a practice to meet this that's so difficult. So may your care for yourself, may your interest in not causing harm to yourself and to others, be a motivation to quietly, peacefully touch, feel, sense well-being. May there be well-being in your heart. Thank you.